If Frangivarn seemed strangely well-informed for a member of a fanatically reclusive set of Diolaters who'd only arrived at the Convox a few hours ago, it was because he had attended the same briefing as I had, a meeting in a chalk hall where a succession of Fras and Sures had gotten the Embrace groups up to speed on diverse topics. Or, taking the more cynical view, fed us what some hierarchs wanted us to know. I was only beginning to get a feel for how real information diffused through the Convox. This touched off a few minutes of banter, which made me impatient until I saw that Moira and Paflagon were using it as an opportunity to catch up with the others in cleaning their plates. Some of the servitors went back to the kitchen to look after dessert. It wasn't until we began to clear away the dinner plates that the conversation paused, and Sur Asquin, after an exchange of glances with Ignatha Forrell, hemmed into her napkin and said,
"Well, what I have collected from what we heard a few minutes ago is that none of the four geometer races has invented new matter."
"Or wishes us to know that they have,"
Lodegear put in.
"Yes, quite. But in any case, each of the four has originated from a cosmos, or a narrative, or a world track, where the constants of nature are ever so slightly different from what they are here."
No one objected. Ignatha Forrell said,
"That, to me, seems like an almost incredibly strange and remarkable finding, and I don't understand why we haven't heard more of it."
"The results of the tests were not definitive until today's laboratorium,"
Javarn said.
"This messel seems to have been thrown together immediately afterwards, actually during Inbrace, as a matter of fact," said Lodegear.
"There were some who had inklings of these results a day or two ago in Lukub,"
said Paflagon.
"Then we ought to have been made aware of it a day or two ago," said Ignatha Forrell.
"It is in the nature of Lukub work that it does not get talked about as readily as what is done in laboratorium,"
Sur Asquin pointed out, deftly playing her role as social facilitator, smoother out of awkward bits. Jad looked at her as if she were a speed bump stretching across the road in front of his mob.
"But there is another reason which Madam Secretary might look on a little more benignly," said Sur Moira. "The predominant hypothesis until this morning was that the propulsion system used by the geometers to travel between star systems had changed their matter somehow."
"Changed their matter?"
"Yes, locally altered the laws and constants of nature."
"Is that plausible?"
"Such a propulsion device was envisioned 2,000 years ago, right here at Tredegar," Moira said. "I brought it up last week. The idea gained currency for a few days, so, you see, it is all my fault."
"The idea would not have gained currency," Fra Jad announced, "but for that many were unsettled, disturbed by talk of other narratives. They longed for an explanation that would not force them to learn a new way of thinking and forgot the rake."
"Most eloquent, Fra Jad," said Mai Doyne. "A fine example of the hidden currents that so often drive what pretends to be rational, theoric discourse."
Fra Jad fixed Lodegear with a look that was hard to read, but not what you'd call warm. I got yanked. I'd learned to recognize Emmons' touch on the rope. Sure enough, he was waiting for me when I entered the kitchen.
"The first thing Madam Secretary will say to me in the mob on her way home is that I have to find my way into the right Lukub."
"You yanked the wrong guy, then," I said. "I just got out of quarantine this morning."
"That's why you're perfect. You're going to be in the market."
The picture, as I'd pieced it together, was that mornings, anti-provener, were spent in laboratorium. I would go to a specific place and work on a given job with others who had been similarly assigned. Post-provener, but before messel, was a part of the day called pericline, when people mixed and mingled and exchanged information, such as laboratorium results, that could be further sorted and propagated in the messels. After messel was Lukub, burning the midnight oil. Everyone was saying there was going to be a lot of Lukub activity tonight because so much of the workday had been wiped out by the Embrace in the plenary. Lukub tended to be where the action was anyway. Everyone here wanted to get things done, but many felt that the structure of laboratorium, messel, and so on was only getting in their way. Lukub was a way for them to exercise a little initiative. You might be working with a bunch of lunkheads all morning. The hierarchs might have assigned you to a real snoozer of a messel, but during Lukub, you could do what you wanted. I'd be happy if you wanted to accompany me to Lukub, I told Emin, and I meant it. But you have to understand that I can't guarantee... I was drowned out by indignant shushing from Archibald and Carvel. Barb turned to me and announced,
They want you to be quiet because they want to hear what is being said in the...
I shushed Barb. Archibald shushed me. Carvel shushed him. The topic seemed to have turned to the crux of the whole evening's discussion. How the idea of world tracks and configuration space were related to the existence of different kinds of matter on Pangae, Diasp, Antarct, Quator, and Arb.
It was a strong meme around the time of the Reconstitution, Moira was saying, that the constants of nature are contingent, not necessary. That is, they could have been otherwise had the early history of the universe been somehow different. As a matter of fact, research into such ideas is how we got new matter in the first place.
So, if I'm following you, Ignatha Forrell said, the correctness of that idea, that those numbers are contingent, was proved by our ability to make new matter.
That is the usual interpretation, said Moira.
When you speak of early history of the universe, put in Lodagir, how early...
We are speaking of an infinitesimal snatch of time just after the Big Bang, Moira said, when the first elementary particles congealed out of a sea of energy.
And the claim is, it happened to congeal in a particular way, Lodagir said. But it could have congealed a little differently, leading to a cosmos with different constants and different matter.
Exactly, said Moira.
How can we translate what's just been said into the language that Fra Jad prefers, of narratives and configuration space? Asked Ignatha Forrell.
I'll take a crack at it, said Paphlagon. If we traced our world track, the series of points through configuration space that is the past, present, and future of our cosmos, backwards in time, we would observe configurations that were hotter and brighter, more closely packed, like running a photomnemonic tablet of an explosion in reverse. It would lead us into regions of hemmed space scarcely recognizable as a cosmos at all, the moments just after the Big Bang. At some point, proceeding backwards, we'd get to a configuration in which the physical constants we've been speaking of...
Those 20 numbers, said Sur Asquin.
Yes, were not even defined. A place so different that those constants would be meaningless. They would have no value, because they still had the freedom to take on any value. Now, up until this point in the story I'm telling you, there really is no difference between the old one-universe picture and the world-track-through-hem-space picture.
Not even when new matter is taken into account? Asked Lodagir.
Not even then, because all the new matter makers did was to build a machine that could create energies that high and then make their own little big bangs in the lab. But what is new to us now, as of this morning's laboratorium findings, is that if you, in the same manner, traced the world tracks of Antarct, of Pangae, Diasp, and Quator backwards, you would find yourself in a very similar part of hem space.
The narratives converge, said Fra Jad.
As you go backwards, you mean,
Javarn said.
There is no backwards, said Fra Jad.
This occasioned a few moments of silence.
Fra Jad doesn't believe in the existence of time, Moira said,
but she sounded as if she were realizing it and saying it at the same moment.
Ah, well, important detail that, said Sir Atriss in the kitchen,
and for once no one shushed her. For some minutes we'd all been standing around a set of dessert plates ready to serve, waiting for the right moment.
I don't recommend we get sidetracked on the question of whether time exists, said Paphlagon,
to the almost audible relief of everyone else.
The point is that in that model that views the five cosmi, Arbor and those of the four geometer races, as trajectories in hem space, those trajectories are extremely close together in the vicinity of the Big Bang. And we might even ask whether they were the same up to a certain point, when something happened that made them split off from one another. Perhaps that is a question for another messel. Perhaps only Diolaters would dare to attempt it.
In the kitchen, we risked glancing at Javarn's servitor.
In any case, the different world tracks ended up with slightly different physical constants. And so you could say that even if we were to sit in a room with a geometer who seemed similar to us, the fact is that they would carry in the very nuclei of their atoms a sort of fingerprint that proved they came from a different narrative.
As our genetic sequences carry a record of every mutation, every adaptation, every ancestor to the first thing that ever lived, said Sur Mora, so the stuff of which they were made would encode what Fra Jad calls the narrative of their cosmos, back to the point in hemspace when we all diverged.
Farther,
Fra Jad said, which was followed by the customary silence that followed most Jad statements. But it was shattered, this time, by a laugh from Lodagir.
I see it. Finally. Oh, what a fool I've been, Fra Jad, not to notice the game you've been playing. But now at last I see where you have been leading us, ever so subtly, to the Hylian theoric world.
I don't know which is more annoying, I said. Lodagir's tone, or the fact that he figured this out before I did. I had been shocked a few hours ago, when Lodagir had wandered up to me during Paracline and begun chit-chatting about our encounter on the plenary stage. How could he come anywhere near me without body armor and a team of stun-gun-brandishing inquisitors? How could he not have foreseen that I'd devote the rest of my life to plotting violent revenge? Which had forced me to understand that it really wasn't personal for him. All the rhetorical tricks, the distortions salted with outright lies, the appeals to emotion, were every bit as much parts of his toolkit as equations and syllogisms were of mine. And he didn't imagine I'd really object, any more than Jessery would if I pointed out an error in his theorics. I had stared dumbly at Lodagir throughout, judging the distance separating my knuckles and his teeth. I had had the vague idea that he was bossing me around a little, concerning this evening's messel, but I hadn't heard any of it. After a while, he had lost interest, since I hadn't said a word, and had wandered off. I don't know how I'm going to make it through this, between him and the Inquisition, I said.
You're already in trouble with the Inquisition?
Arcibald asked, sounding amazed and appreciative at the same time.
No, but Varex let me know he's watching me, I said.
How in the world did he do that?
Earlier, I had a really annoying encounter with Lodagir.
Yes, I saw it.
No, I mean I had a second one. And a few seconds later, guess who walked up to me?
Well, given the context in which you are telling the story, Arcibald said, I would have to guess it was Varax.
Yeah.
What did Varax say?
He said, I understand you're up to Chapter 5. Hope it didn't ruin your whole autumn. And I told him that it had taken me a few weeks, but I didn't blame him for what had happened.
That was all?
Yeah, maybe some chit-chat afterwards.
And how do you interpret those words of Varax?
He was saying, don't pop your doin in the nose, young man, I'm watching you.
Oh, you're an idiot.
What?
You've got it all wrong. This was a gift.
A gift? Arcibald explained.
A doin has the power to discipline his servitor by assigning chapters in the book. But you, Raz, hardened criminal that you are already up to 5. Lodagir would have to give you 6, a very heavy punishment.
Which I could appeal, I said, getting it. Appeal to the Inquisition. Arcibald's right, said Triss, who'd been listening, and who seemed to be looking at me in a whole new way now that she knew I was up to 5. It sounds to me like this Varax was giving you a big fat hint that the Inquisition would throw out any sentence from Lodagir.
They would almost have to, said Arcibald.
I picked up Lodagir's dessert and headed for the Messalin in a whole new mood. The others followed me.
We came into a room of flushed faces and bitten lips, a tableau of strained and awkward body language.
Lodegear had been having his usual effect on people. "Just when I'd thought we were getting somewhere," Ignatha Forel was saying, "I see that once again the messel has been sidetracked into some old and tedious dispute between Procyons and Halicarnians. Metatheorics! Sometimes I wonder whether you in the Mathic world really understand the stakes that are now in play." Clearly, I had come in at the wrong moment. But it was too late now, and others were piling up behind me. So I barged on in and gave my Doyne his dessert, just as he was saying,
"I accept your rebuke, Madam Secretary, and I assure you that—" "I don't accept it," said Fra Jad.
"Nor should you," put in Javarn.
"These matters are important whether or not you take the trouble to understand them,"
Fra Jad went on. "How am I to distinguish this from the partisan bickering that goes on in the capital?" Ignatha Forel asked. Others at the table had been horrified by Fra Jad's tone, but she seemed to find it bracing. Fra Jad ignored the question, it was none of his concern, and turned his energies to his dessert. Fra Javarn, who was surprising us all with his interest in the topic, took it up.
"By examining the quality of the arguments."
"When the arguments come out of pure theorics, I am unable to make such judgments," she pointed out.
"I would not assume that the existence of the Hylaean theoric world comes out of what is called pure theorics,"
Lodegear said.
"It is as much a leap of faith as believing in God."
"As much as I admire the ingenuity with which you find a way to skewer Fra Jad and Fra Javern with the same sentence," said Ignatha Forel, "I must remind you that most of the people I work with believe in God, and so, among them, your gambit is likely to backfire."
"The hour is late,"
Sir Asquin pointed out, though no one seemed tired.
"I propose that we take up the topic of the Hylaean theoric world in tomorrow evening's messel."
Fra Jad nodded, but it was hard to tell whether he was accepting the challenge or really enjoying the cake.
Everything Killer. A weapons system of unusual praxic sophistication, thought to have been used to devastating effect in the terrible events. The belief is widely held, but unproved, that the complicity of Theors in the development of this praxis led to universal agreement that they should henceforth be segregated from non-theorical society, a policy that, when effected, became synonymous with the Reconstitution. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
"Have you all been enjoying your books?" Sir Moira inquired, then seized a pan and began scraping dead vegetables into the compost. Carvel gasped. Moira had sneaked in and ambushed us. She dropped the pot she had been scrubbing, spun away from the sink, and ran over to take the pan out of her old Doyne's frail hands. Arcibalt and I turned almost as adroitly to watch. Carvel might be swathed in a ton of black bolt, but as we'd been noticing, the lashings that held it in place around her body were most intricate and rewarded close examination. Even Barb looked. Emin Beldo was driving Ignatha Forel back to her lodgings. Javarn's servitor, Orhan, was a hard man, or woman, to read with his or her head totally covered, but the wrinkles in his or her bolt told me his or her head was tracking Carvel. Triss took advantage of this to steal the best scrub brush.
"Were you responsible for the books?" I asked.
"I had Carvel place them in your trailer," Moira said, and gave me a smile.
"So that's where those came from,"
Triss said, then explained.
"I found a stack of books in my cell this morning."
From the way other servitors were now looking at Moira, I guessed they'd had similar experiences.
"Wait a minute, that is chronologically impossible,"
Barb pointed out, and then, showing a flash of the old Barb wit, added,
"Unless you violated the rules of causality."
"Oh, I've been trying to get this vessel started for a few days," Moira said. "Just ask Sir Asquin. She'll tell you what a pest I've made of myself."
"You don't really think something like this could be thrown together by a bunch of hierarchs passing notes around during embrace, do you?"
"Grand Sir Moira," Arcibalt began, "if it wasn't this morning's laboratorium results that brought this messel into being, what was it?"
"Well,
if you weren't too busy flirting with these lovely sewers and horsing around in the kitchen, you might have heard me earlier speaking of being a metalorite.
Or a plurality of worlds lorite, I said.
Ah, so you were paying attention.
I thought it was just an icebreaker.
Who was there, Evanedric, Fra Arcibald?
I beg your pardon?
Arcibald was fascinated by the question, but soon had his hands full as Sewer Triss dumped a huge greasy platter into his arms.
Fra Taverner, who was the Sondhemn on the planet of Quator? Triss, who was the Lady Barateau of Antarct? Fra Oren, do they worship a god on Pangy, and is it the same as the god of the Matarites?
It must be, Grand Sewer Moira,
Orhan exclaimed, and made a gesture with his hand, I had decided he had to be male, that I'd seen before. Some kind of Diolater superstition.
Fra Erasmus, who discovered Halicarn's diagonal on the world of Diasp?
Because obviously they did think such thoughts, you're saying, Arcibald said.
They must have done, to build that ship, said Barb. Your minds are so much fresher, more agile than some of those who sit in that Messalin,
Moira said.
I thought you might have ideas.
Sewer Triss turned around and asked,
Are you saying that there would be one-to-one correspondences between our sons and theirs? Like the same mind shared across multiple worlds?
I'm asking you, Moira said.
I had nothing to say, being stricken with the all-too-familiar feeling of unease that came over me lately when conversations began to wander down this path. The last words Orlo had spoken to me, a few minutes before he had died, had been a warning that the Thousanders knew about this stuff and had been developing a praxis around it, in effect, that the legends of the Encanters were based in fact. And perhaps I'd fallen back into my old habit of worrying too much, but it seemed to me now that every conversation I was part of came dangerously close to this topic. Arcibald, unburdened by such cares, felt ready to have a go. He heaved a platter into a drying rack, wiped his hands on his bolt, and squared off.
Well, any such hypothesis would have to be grounded in some account of why different minds and different world tracks would think similar things. One could always look to a religious explanation, he went on, with a glance at Orhan. But other than that, well...
You needn't be reticent about your belief in the HTW. Remember who you're talking to. I've seen it all.
Yes, Grand Sir Moira,
Arcibald said, with a dip of the head.
How might the knowledge propagate from a common theoric world? I won't call it Hylaean, since presumably there was no person named Hylaea on Quator, to the minds of different Sants in different worlds. And is it still going on at this moment, between us and them?
Moira had been edging toward the back door as she tossed these mind bombs into the kitchen, and now almost collided with Emmon Beldo, fresh in from escorting his Doyne home.
Well, it sounds as though the Messal will discuss that tomorrow, I pointed out.
Why wait? Don't be complacent,
Moira shot back as she was storming out into the night. Carval threw down a towel and scurried after her, drawing her bolt up over her head. Emmon politely got out of her way, then swiveled to watch Carval until there was nothing left to see. When he turned back around, he got a sponge in the face from Sewer Triss.
You can't just have these tracks wandering around in hemmed space, said Emmon.
The way we're wandering around in the dark, I proposed, for we were attempting to find a suitable Lukab.
With no rhyme or reason, can you?
You mean the world tracks, the narratives?
I guess so. What is up with that, by the way?
It was a vague question, but I could tell what was on his mind.
You mean Frajad's use of the word narrative?
Yeah. That's going to be a hard one to sell to...
the Pangendrums? Is that what you call people like my Doyne?
Oh, some of us.
Well, they're pretty hard-headed. Don't go in for anything highfalutin.
Well, let me see if I can come up with an example, I said. Remember what Arcibald said? The block of ice buried in the star?
Yeah, sure,
he said.
There is a point in hemmed space that represents a cosmos that includes even that.
The configuration of the cosmos encoded in that point, I said, includes, along with all the stars and planets, the birds and the bees, the books and the spielies and everything else, one star that happens to have a big chunk of ice in the middle of it. That point, remember, is just a long string of numbers, coordinates in the space. No more or less real than any other possible string of numbers.
Its realness or unrealness in this case has to grow out of some other consideration, Emmon tried.
You got it. And in this case, it is that the situation being described is so damned ridiculous.
Well, how could it ever happen to begin with?
Emmon demanded, getting into the spirit. Happen. That's the key word, I said, wishing I could explain this as confidently as Orlo. What does it mean for something to happen? That sounded pretty lame. It's not just this situation, this isolated point in configuration space, that springs into being for a moment and then vanishes. It's not like you have a normal star and then suddenly for one tick of the cosmic clock, a block of ice materializes in the middle of it, and then next tick, poof, it's gone without a trace.
But it could happen, couldn't it? If you had a hem-space teleporter?
That's a useful thought experiment, I said. You're thinking of a gadget from one of Moira's novels. A magic booth where you could dial in any point in hem-space, realize it, and then jump to another.
Yeah, regardless of the laws of theorics or whatever. Then you could make the ice block materialize, but then it would melt.
It would melt, I corrected him, if you let natural law take over from that point. But you could preserve it by making your hem-space teleporter jump to another point, encoding the same cosmos an instant later, but with the block of ice still included.
Okay, I get it. But normally it would melt.
So, Emmon, the question is, what means normally? Another way of putting it, if you look at the series of points you'd have to string together with your hem-space teleporter in order to see, outside the windows of the booth, a cosmos with a block of ice persisting in the middle of a star, how different would that series of points have to be from one that was a proper world track?
Meaning a world track where natural laws were respected.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We laughed. Well, I said, I'm now starting to understand some of what Orlo was saying to me about Sant Evanedric. Evanedric studied Datonomy, an outgrowth of Skonic philosophy, which means what is given to us, what we observe. In the end, that's all we have to work with.
I'll bite, Emmon said. What do we observe?
Not just world points that are coherent, I said. So, no ice blocks and stars, but coherent series of such points. A world track that could have happened.
What's the difference?
It's not just that you can't have a block of ice in a star, but that you can't get it there. You can't keep it there. There is no coherent history that can include it. See, it's not just about what is possible, since anything is possible in hem-space, but what is compossible, meaning all the other things that would have to be true in that universe to have a block of ice in a star.
Well, I actually think you could do it, Emmon said.
The praxic gears were turning in his head. This was what he did for a living. He had been pulled out of his job at a rocket agency to serve as technical advisor to Ignatha Forel.
You could design a rocket, a missile with a warhead made of thick, heat-resistant material with a block of ice embedded in it. Make this thing plunge into the star at high velocity. The heat-resistant material would burn away, but just after it did, for a moment, you'd have a block of ice embedded in a star.
Okay, that's all possible, I said. But it's a way of answering the question, what other things would have to be true about a cosmos that included a block of ice in a star? If you were to go to that cosmos and freeze it in that moment of time...
Okay, he said. Let's say the teleporter has a user interface feature that makes it easy to freeze time by looping back to the same point over and over.
Fine. And if you did that and looked at the region around the ice, you'd see the heavy nuclei of the melted heat shield swirling around in the star stuff. You'd see the trail of rocket exhaust in space leading all the way back to the scorch marks on the launch pad. That launch pad has to be on a planet capable of supporting life smart enough to build rockets. Around that launch pad, you'd see people who had spent years of their lives designing and building that rocket. Memories of that work and of the launch would be encoded in their neurons. spieles of the launch would be stored in their reticules. And all of those memories and recordings would mostly agree with one another. All of those memories and recordings boiled down to positions of atoms in space, so those memories and recordings, you're saying, are themselves part of the configuration encoded by that point in Hem's space, Emmon said, loudly and firmly, as he knew he was getting it. And that is what you mean about compossibility.
Yes.
Ice in a star could be encoded by many Hem space points, he said, but only a few of them, a vanishingly tiny few, I said, include all the records, coherent, mutually consistent records, of how it got to be there.
Yes.
When you go all praxic on me and dream up the ice missile delivery system, what you're really doing is figuring out what narrative would create the set of conditions, the traces left behind in the cosmos by the execution of that project, that is compossible with ice in a star. We walked on for a bit, and he said,
or to give a less dignified example, you can't look at Sewer Carval's outfit
without having to reconstruct in your mind the sequence of operations needed to tie all those knots,
or to untie them.
She's a hundreder, I warned him, and the Convox won't last forever.
Don't get too attached.
Yeah, I know, but I could still get a date with her in 3700. Or become a Fraw, I suggested.
I might have to, after this.
Hey, do you know where you're going?
Yeah, I'm following you.
I've been following you.
Okay, that would mean that we're lost.
And we stumbled about until we encountered a pair of grand sewers out for a stroll and asked them for directions to the Edharian chapter house.
So, Emmon said after we had set out on the right track, the bottom line is that in any one particular cosmos, excuse me, on any one particular world track, things make sense. The laws of nature are followed.
Yes, I said. That's what a world track is. A sequence of Hem space points strung together just so to make it look like the laws of nature are preserved.
I'm going to put that in teleporter terms, since that's how I'll be explaining it to people, he said. The whole point of the teleporter is that it could take you to any other point at any moment. You could jump randomly from one cosmos to another. But only one point in Hem space encodes the state that the cosmos you're in now will have at the next tick of the clock, if the laws of nature are followed, right?
You're on the right track, I said. But
where I'm going with this, he said, is as follows. I have to explain this to the people you call pangendrums. They have heard of the laws of nature, maybe even studied them a bit. They're comfortable with that. Now suddenly I come in and start talking about Hem space, a new concept to them. I give them a big explanation. I talk about the teleporter, the ice in the star, and the scorch marks on the launch pad. Finally, one of these people raises his hand and says, Mr. Beldo, you have squandered hours of our valuable time giving us a calca on Hem space. What, pray tell, is the bottom line? And my answer, Raz, is, if you please, sir, the bottom line is that the laws of nature are followed in our cosmos. And he's going to say,
we already knew that, you idiot. You're fired.
Exactly. Which is when I have to run off and become a Fraw, preferably in Carval's math.
So you are asking me,
what do we gain that is consequential by adopting the Hem space model? You already mentioned it makes it easier to do theorics, but pangendrums don't do theorics.
Well, for one thing, it is actually not the case that at any given point, there is only one next point that is consistent with the laws of nature.
Oh, are you going to talk about quantum mechanics?
Yeah. An elementary particle can decay, which is compatible with the laws of nature, or it cannot decay, which is also compatible with the laws of nature. But decaying and not decaying takes us to two different points in Hem space.
The world track forks.
Yeah. World tracks fork all the time, whenever quantum state reduction seems to occur, which is a lot.
But still, whatever world track we happen to be on still always obeys the laws of nature, he said.
I'm afraid so.
So, back to my original problem.
What does Hem space get us?
Well, for one thing, it makes it a heck of a lot easier to think about quantum mechanics. But pangendrums don't think about quantum mechanics.
I had nothing to say.
I just felt like a clueless avout.
So, do you think I should mention the hemspace thing at all?
Let's ask Jessery, I proposed. He's cool-looking. For we had reached the Adharian cloister, and I spied him on a path, drawing diagrams in the gravel with a stick while a Fra and Asur stood by, watching and laughing delightedly. In the moonlight, these people looked as though they'd been sketched in ash on a fireplace floor. Still, they cut altogether different figures. Jessery looked like a young prophet from some ancient scripture next to the Fra and the Sewer, who came from more cosmopolitan orders that went in for fancy raps. This morning at Inbrace, I had felt like a real hick when I had looked at how the other avout dressed, but that was just me. Put the same outfit on Jessery and he became awe-inspiringly rugged, simple, austere, and, well, manly. I understood, as I looked at him, why Fra Lodegear had been so keen to plane me. There was something about the Adharian contingent that impressed people. Orlo had made us into stars. Lodegear had seen the plenary as an opportunity to take one of us down a peg. Jessery, I called.
Hi, Raz. I am not one of those people who think you sucked at the plenary.
Thanks. Name one thing we get by working in configuration space that we don't get any other way.
Time,
he said. Oh, yeah, I said. Time.
I thought time didn't exist, Emin said sarcastically.
Jessery looked at Emin for a few moments, then looked at me.
What, has your friend been talking to Fra Jad?
It is nice that Hemspace gives us an account of time, I said. But Emin will say that the Panchendrums he has to talk to already believe in the existence of time.
Poor benighted fools,
Jessery exclaimed, getting a low, painful laugh out of Emin, and quizzical looks from his avowed companions. So of what relevance to them is the Hemspace picture? I continued.
None whatsoever, Jessery said. Until strangers come to town from four different cosmi at once. Hey, can I get you guys something to drink?
It was yet another of Jessery's annoying qualities that he did some of his finest work while drunk. We servitors had sampled our share of wine and beer in the kitchen, and I was just beginning to get my head clear, so I decided to drink water. Presently, we found ourselves in the largest chalk hall of the local Adharian chapter, or at least I assumed it had to be the largest. The slate walls were covered with calculations I recognized.
They've got you doing cosmography? I asked.
Jessery followed my gaze and focused on a table of figures chalked up on a slate. One column was longitude, another latitude, and seeing 51 degrees and change chalked up in the latter, I realized I was looking at the coordinates of Sant Edhar.
This morning's laboratorium, he explained. We had to check a bunch of calculations that the ETA did last night. All of the world's telescopes, including the M&M, as you can see, are to be pointed at the geometer's ship tonight.
All night long, or...
No, in about half an hour.
Something is going to happen, Jessery proclaimed in his usual confident baritone. I noticed Emin cringing.
Something that will give us a different view, Jessery went on. More interesting than the pusher plate on its arse, which I spent so many hours staring at.
How do we know this? I asked, though I was a little distracted by Emin's conspicuous nervousness.
I don't, Jessery said. I'm just inferring it.
Emin jerked his head toward the exit, and we followed him out into the cloister.
I'll tell you guys, he said, once we had gotten out of earshot of the rest of the Lukab, since the secret is going to be out in half an hour anyway. This is an idea that was cooked up at a very influential messal after the visitation of Orathena.
Were you in on it? I asked.
No, but it's why I was brought here, Emin said. We have an old reconnaissance bird up there in synchronous orbit. It's got loads of fuel on board so that it can move around when we tell it to. We don't think the geometers know about it. We've kept the bird silent so it hasn't occurred to them to jam its frequencies. Well, earlier today we narrow-beamed a burst of commands to the thing and it fired up its thrusters and placed itself into a new orbit that will intercept that of the Hedron in half an hour. He used his toe to render the geometer's ship in the gravel path. A crude polygon for the envelope of the icosahedron, a heel stomp on one edge for the pusher plate. This thing is always pointed at Arb, he complained, tapping his toe on the pusher plate. So we can't see the rest of the ship.
he swept his foot in an arc around the forward half, which is where they keep all of the cool stuff. Obviously, a deliberate move. This half has been like the dark side of the moon to us, so we've had to rely entirely on Son Orlo's phototype. He stepped around to the flank of the diagram and swept out a long arc aimed at the bow. Our bird, he said, is approaching from this direction. It is radioactive as hell. The bird is? Yeah. It draws power from radiothermal devices. The geometers are going to notice this thing headed their way, and they'll have no choice but to execute a maneuver
to get the pusher plate, which is their shield, between themselves and the bogey, Jessery said.
They'll have to spin the whole ship around, I translated, exposing the cool stuff to view from ground-based telescopes.
And those telescopes are going to be ready.
But is it even possible to spin something that big around in any reasonable amount of time? I asked. I'm trying to imagine how big the thrusters would have to be. Emmons shrugged.
You ask a good question. We'll learn a lot just from observing its maneuver. Tomorrow, we'll have lots of pictures to look at.
Unless they get angry and nuke us,
Jessery put in, while I was trying to think of a more delicate way of saying it.
Yeah, there's been some discussion of that, Emmon admitted.
Well, I should hope so, I said.
The Pangendrums are all sleeping in caves and bunkers.
Well, that's comforting, Jessery said.
Emmon missed the sarcasm.
And the Mathic world has experience in coping with nuclear aftermaths.
Jessery and I both turned to look in the direction of the precipice, wondering how deep we could get in those tunnels. How fast.
But this is all considered low probability, Emmon said. What happened on Ekba was a serious provocation, if not an outright act of war. We have to make a serious response. Show the geometers we won't just sit passively while they drop rods on us.
Will this bird actually hit the icosahedron? I asked.
Not unless they're stupid enough to get in its way. But it'll come close enough that they'll have to respond, as a precaution.
Well, Jessery said, after we had spent a minute absorbing all of this.
So much for getting anything done during Lukub.
Yeah, I said. I guess I will have wine after all. We took a bottle out onto the lawn between the Adharian and 11th Sconic cloisters. We knew where to look in the sky, so we arranged ourselves and lay in the grass, waiting for the end of the world. I really missed Ayla. For a while, I hadn't been thinking about her much. But she was the one I wanted to be next to when the nukes rained down. At the appointed moment, there was a tiny momentary flash of light in the middle of the constellation where we knew the Hedron was, as though a spark had jumped between their ship and our bird.
They nailed it with something, Emmon said.
Directed energy weapon, Jessery intoned,
as if he actually knew what he was talking about.
X-ray laser, actually,
said a nearby voice. We sat up to see a stocky figure in an antique bolt and cord getup shambling toward us on weary legs. Hello, Leo, I called out.
Feel like a stroll while we await massive retaliation?
Sure, I said.
I'm going to bed, Jessery said.
I guessed he was lying.
No look up tonight.
Definitely lying.
Then I'm doing the same, said
Emmon Beldo, who knew when he was being gotten rid of.
Lots of work tomorrow.
If we still exist, Jessery said.
I really have to get in touch with Ayla, I told Leo after we had wandered for half an hour without saying a word. I looked for her at Paracline this afternoon, but...
She wasn't there,
Leo said.
She was getting ready for this.
You mean aiming the telescopes, or...
More the military side of it.
How'd she get mixed up in that?
She's good. Someone noticed. The military gets what it asks for.
How would you know? Are you mixed up in the military side, too?
Leo was silent. We walked for a few minutes more.
A few days ago, they put me in a new laboratorium,
he said. I could tell he had been laboring to get it off his chest for a while.
Oh, really? What have they got you doing?
They dug up some old documents. Really old. We've been scraping them off, getting familiar with them, looking up old words, fallen from use.
What kinds of documents?
technical drawings, specs, manuals, back of envelope sketches even.
For what?
They won't just come out and say, and no one is allowed to see the whole picture,
Leo said.
But talking to some of the others, comparing notes in Lukub, taking into account the dates on the documents just before the terrible events, we're all pretty sure that what we are looking at are the original plans for the Everything Killers.
I gave a little snort of laughter, simply out of habit. The Everything Killers were only ever mentioned in the same way as we might talk of God or Hell. But everything about Leo's tone and manner told me that he was being altogether literal. There was a long silence while I tried to absorb this news. In an attempt to prove that he must be mistaken, I pointed out, "But that goes against everything that the world is based on," meaning the post-reconstitution world. If they're willing to do that, then nothing is real anymore.
There are many who agree with you, of course, Leo said. And that's why...
He exhaled, the breath coming out raggedly.
That's why I wanted to invite you to be part of my Lukub.
What's the purpose of this Lukub?
Some people are thinking of going over to the Antarks.
Going over, as in joining forces with? With the Geometers?
The Antarks,
he insisted.
It's been established now that the dead woman in the probe was from Antarct.
Based on the blood samples in the tubes? He nodded.
But the projectiles in her body are from the Pangee cosmos.
So people are guessing that the Antarks are on our side? He nodded again.
And having some sort of conflict up there with the Pangees.
So the idea is to forge an alliance between the Avowed and the Antarks?
You got it,
Leo said. Wow. How exactly would you go about that? How would you even communicate with them? I mean, so that the secular power wouldn't know of it.
Easy. Already been worked out.
Then, knowing I'd never be satisfied with that, he added,
It's the guide star lasers on the big telescopes. We can aim them at the icosahedron. They'll see the light, but it can't be intercepted by anyone who's not right on the beamline.
I thought of the conversation I'd had with Leo months ago, when we had wondered whether it was really true or just an old folktale that the Eta had us under continual surveillance. Idiotically, I looked around just in case any hidden microphones might somehow have popped into view. Do the Eta...
Some of them are in on it,
Leo said. What kind of relationship exactly do these people want to forge with the Antarks?
We spend most of our time arguing about that. Too much time. There are some nutjobs, of course, who think we can go up there and live on their ship. It'll be like ascending to heaven. Most are more reasonable. We'll set up our own communications to the Geometers and conduct our own negotiations.
But that is totally at odds with the Reconstitution.
Does the Reconstitution say anything about aliens? About multiple cosmi?
I shut up, knowing when I was planed.
Anyway,
he went on. I completed his sentence. The Reconstitution is a dead letter anyway if they are dusting off the Everything Killers.
The term post-mathic is being thrown around,
Leo said.
People are talking about the second rebirth.
Who's in on it?
Quite a few servitors. Not so many doings, if you follow me.
What orders? What maths?
Well, the Ringing Veil Avowed consider the Everything Killers to be dishonorable, if that helps you.
Where does this Lukub meet? It sounds huge.
It's a bunch of Lukubs. A network of cells. We talk to one another.
What do you do, Leo?
Stand in the back of the room and look tough. Listen.
What are you listening for?
There are some crazies,
he said.
Well, not crazy, but too rational, if you know what I mean. No awareness of tactics, of discretion.
And what are those people saying?
That it's time for the smart people to be in charge. Time to take the power back from people like the Warden of Heaven.
That kind of talk could lead to a fourth sack, I said.
Some people are way ahead of you,
Leo said.
They are saying, fine, bring it on. The Geometers will intervene on our side.
That is just shockingly reckless, I said.
That's why I'm listening to those people,
Leo said,
and reporting back to my Lukub group. which seems reasonable by comparison.
Why would the geometers reach down to stop a sack?
People who believe this tend to be hardcore HTW types, I'm sorry to say. They've seen the Adrakonic proof on Orlo's phototype. They assume that the geometers are our brothers. The fact that the geometers made their first landfall at Orathena just confirms this.
Leo, I have a question.
Okay.
I've had zero contact with Ayla. Jessery thinks it's because she's trying to get her liaison sorted, but that doesn't seem like her. Does she know anything about this group?
She started it,
Leo said.
Sphenix. A school of Theors, well represented in ancient Ethras, where they were hired by well-to-do families as tutors for their children. In many classic dialogues, seen in opposition to Telenes, Protas, or others of their school. Their most prominent champion was Uraloebus, who in the dialogue of the same name was plagued so badly by Telenes that he committed suicide on the spot. They disputed the views of Protas and, broadly speaking, preferred to believe that Theorix took place entirely between the ears, with no recourse to external realities such as the Proton forms. The forerunners of Sant Proc, the syntactic faculties, and the Protians. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Paphlagon's plate was clean. Lodigir hadn't even picked up his fork. Hunger at last succeeded where throat-clearing, glares, exasperated sighs, and the unmasked departure of the servitors had failed. Lodigir fell silent, picked up his glass, and doused his flaming vocal cords. Paphlagon was eerily calm, almost jolly.
If one were to examine a transcript of that, one would see an extraordinary and quite lengthy catalogue of every rhetorical trick in the Sphenic book. We've seen appeals to mob sentiment. No one believes in the HTW anymore. Everyone thinks protism is crazy. We've seen appeals to authority, refuted in the 29th century by no less than Saint so-and-so. Efforts to play on our personal insecurity. How can any person of sound mind take this seriously? And many other techniques that I have forgotten the names of, as it has been so long since I studied the Sphenix. So, I must begin by applauding the rhetorical mastery that has given the rest of us an opportunity to enjoy this excellent meal and rest our voices. But I would be remiss if I did not point out that Fra Lodigir has yet to offer up a single argument worthy of the name against the proposition that there is a Hylaean theoric world, that it is populated by mathematical entities, Knoans as we call them, that are non-spatial and non-temporal in nature, and that our minds have some capability of accessing them.
Nor could I ever,
exclaimed Fra Lodigir, whose jaw had been working at an astounding pace during the last few moments to get a bite of food squared away.
You protists are ever so careful to frame the discussion so that it can't be touched by rational debate. I can't prove you're wrong any more than I can prove the non-existence of God.
Paphlagon had some infighting skills of his own. He simply ignored what Lodigir had just said.
A couple of weeks ago, at a plenary, you and some other of the Procyons floated the suggestion that the diagram of the Adrakonic theorem on the geometer's ship was a forgery, inserted into Saint Orlo's phototype by Orlo himself or someone else at Edhar. Do you now retract that allegation?
And Paphlagon glanced over his shoulder at an astoundingly high-resolution phototype of the geometer's ship, taken last night by the largest optical telescope on Arbor, on which the diagram was clearly visible. The walls of the Messalin were papered with such. The table was scattered with more.
There is nothing wrong with mentioning hypotheses in the course of a discussion,
Lodigir said.
Clearly that particular one happened to be incorrect.
I think he just said yes, I withdraw the allegation, said Triss, back in the kitchen. I'd gone back there ostensibly to fulfill my duties, but really to plow through heaps of more phototypes. Everyone in the convox had been looking at them all day, but we weren't even close to being tired of it.
It is such good fortune that this gambit worked,
Emmon reflected, gazing fixedly at a grainy close-up of a strut.
You mean that we did not get rotted?
Barb asked, sincerely.
No, that we got pictures, Emmon said. Got them by doing something clever here.
Oh, you mean it is good fortune politically?
Carvel asked, a little uncertain.
Yes, yes,
Emmon exclaimed.
The Convox is expensive. It makes the powers that be happy when it yields discernible results.
Why is it expensive? Triss asked. We grow our own food. Emmon finally looked up from his pictures. He was checking Triss's face in order to see whether she could possibly be serious. Over the speaker, Paphlagon was saying,
The Adraconic theorem is true here. It's apparently true in the four cosmi the geometers came from. If their ship had turned up in some other cosmos, the same as ours, but devoid of sentient beings, would it be true there?
Not until the geometers arrived to say it was true, said Lodegear.
Back in the kitchen, I intervened before Emmon could blurt out anything he might have to apologize for. It must be expensive for people like Emmon and Ignatha Forl to keep tabs on it, I pointed out.
Of course, Emmon said. But even if you ignore that, there's a huge amount of mathic effort going into it. Thousands of avout working night and day. Seculars don't like wasted effort. That goes double for seculars who know a thing or two about management.
Management was a fluckish word. Faces went blank around the kitchen. I stepped in to translate. Just because the Pandrondrums know how to run cheeseburg stands, they think they know how to run a Convox. Lots of people putting in time with no results makes them nervous.
Oh, I see,
Triss said uncertainly.
How funny,
Carvel said, and went back to work. Emmon rolled his eyes.
I admit I am no Theor, Ignatha Forl was saying on the speaker. But the more I hear of this, the less I understand your position, Frau Lodegear. Three is a prime number. It is prime today, was prime yesterday. A billion years ago, before there were brains to think about it, it was prime. And if all the brains were destroyed tomorrow, it would still be prime. Clearly, its primeness has nothing to do with our brains.
It has everything to do with our brains,
Lodegear insisted,
because we supply the definition of what it is to be a prime number.
No Theor who attends to these matters can long escape the conclusion that the Canoans exist independently of what may or may not be going on in people's brains at any given moment,
Paphlagon said.
It is a simple application of the Steelyard. What is the simplest way of explaining the fact that Theors, working independently in different eras, different sub-disciplines, different cosmi even, time and time again prove the same results? Results that do not contradict each other even though reached by different proof chains. Results, some of which can be turned into theories that perfectly describe the behavior of the physical universe. The simplest answer is that the Canoans really exist and are not of this causal domain.
Arcibald's bell jingled. I decided to go in with him. We took down a huge rendering of the icosahedron that had been pinned to a tapestry behind Paphlagon. Carvel and Triss came out and helped take the tapestry down, exposing a wall of dark gray slate and a basket of chalk. The dialogue had turned to an exposition of complex versus simple protism, and so Arcibald was called upon to draw on that slate the same sorts of diagrams that Frau Kriskin had drawn in the dust of the road up Bly's Butte when he had explained this topic to me and Leo some weeks earlier. The freight train, the firing squad, the wick, and so on. I drifted back and forth between there and the kitchen as the exposition went on. Ignatha Forl had long been familiar with this material, but it was new to several of the others. Javarn, in particular, asked several questions. Emmon, for once, understood less of what was going on than his Doyne, and so as he and I worked on garnishes for the desserts, I watched his face and jumped in with little explanations when his eyes went out of focus. I returned to the Messalin to clear plates, just as Paphlagon was explaining the wick.
A fully generalized, directed acyclic graph, with no distinction made anymore between, on the one hand, so-called theoric worlds, and on the other, inhabited ones such as Arb, Quator, and the rest. For the first time, we have arrows leading away from the Arbran causal domain toward other inhabited worlds.
Do you mean to suggest,
Lodigir asked, as though not quite believing his ears,
that Arb might be the Hylaean theoric world of some other world that has people living on it?
Of any number of such worlds,
Paphlagon said,
which might themselves be the HTWs of still other worlds.
But how could we possibly verify such a hypothesis?
Lodigir demanded.
We could not, Jad admitted,
in his first utterance of the whole evening,
unless those worlds came to us.
Lodigir broke into rich laughter.
Frodjad, I commend you. What would this messel be without your punchlines? I don't agree with a word of what you're saying, but it does make for an entertaining, because completely unpredictable, mealtime.
I heard the first part of this in person, the back half over the speaker in the kitchen, to which I had repaired with an armload of plates. Emin was standing over the counter where we had spread out the phototypes, thumbing something into his G-jaw. He ignored me, but he did glance up and fix his gaze on nothing in particular as Ignath Aforal began to speak.
The material is interesting, the explanation well carried off, but I am at a loss now. Yesterday evening we were told one story about how plurality of worlds might be understood, and it had to do with hem space and world tracks.
Which I spent all day explaining to rooms full of bureaucrats,
Emin complained, with a theatrical yawn.
And now this.
Now, Ignath Aforal was saying, we are hearing an altogether different account of it, which seems to have nothing to do with the first. I cannot help but wonder whether tomorrow's messel will bring another story, and the day after that yet another.
This touched off a round of not very interesting conversation in the messel, and the servitors pounced and cleared. Archibald trudged to the kitchen and busied himself at the keg.
I'd best fortify myself,
he explained to no one in particular,
as I am condemned to spend the remainder of the evening drawing light bubbles.
What's a light bubble? Emin asked me quietly.
A diagram that shows how information, cause and effect, moves across space and time.
Time which doesn't exist,
Emin said, repeating what had become a stock joke.
Yeah, but it's okay. Space doesn't exist either, I said.
Emin threw me a sharp look and decided I must be pulling his leg.
So, how's your friend Leo doing?
Emin asked. Apropos of yesterday evening. It was noteworthy that he knew Leo's name, since there had been no formal introduction. In the Convox, people met one another in myriad ways, though, so they might have crossed paths anywhere. I would not have given this a second thought, if not for the substance of what Leo and I had talked about. Yesterday I had felt easy around Emin. Today it was different. People I cared about were being drawn into, in Aelis' case perhaps, leading, a subversive movement. Leo was trying to draw me into it even as Emin wanted to follow me to Lukab. Could it be that the secular power had got wind of it, and that Emin's real mission was to ferret it out, using me as a way in? Not a very nice way to think, but that was the way I was going to have to think from now on. I'd lain awake in my cell all night from a combination of jet lag and fear of a fourth sack. Good thing that most of the day had been a huge plenary at which the story of last night's satellite gambit had been told and phototypes and spieles exhibited. The back pews of the Unarian nave were dark and roomy enough that I and scores of Lukab weary of out had been able to stretch out full length and catch up on sleep. When it was over, someone had shaken me awake. I had stood up, rubbed my eyes, looked across the nave, and caught sight of Ayla. The first time I'd seen her since she had stepped through the screen at Voco. She had been 100 feet away, standing in a circle of taller of out, mostly men, all older, but seemingly holding her own in some kind of serious conversation. Some of the men had been seculars in military uniforms. I had decided that now was not the best time for me to bounce up to her and say hello.
Hey, Raz. Raz, how many fingers am I holding up?
Emin was demanding. Triss and Carvel thought that was funny.
How's Leo doing? He repeated.
Busy, I said. Busy like all of us. He's been working out quite a bit with the Ringing Veil of Out, I offered. That's his laboratorium.
Emmon shook his head.
Nice that they're getting exercise, he said. Love to know what joint locks and nerve pinches are going to do against the world burner.
My gaze went to the stack of phototypes. Emmon slid a few out of the way and came up with a detail shot of a detachable pod bracketed to one of the shock absorbers. It was a squat gray metal egg, unmarked and undecorated. A structural lattice had been built around it to provide mountings for antennae, thrusters, and spherical tanks. Clearly, the thing was meant to detach and move around under its own power. Holding it to the shock absorber was a system of brackets that reached through the lattice to engage the gray egg directly. This detail had drawn notice from the Convox. Calculations had been done on the size of those brackets. They were strangely oversized. They only needed to be so large if the thing they were holding, the gray egg, were massive. Unbelievably massive. This was no ordinary pressure vessel. Perhaps it had extremely thick walls, but the calculations made no sense if you assumed any sort of ordinary metal. The only way to sort it, to account for the sheer number of protons and neutrons in that thing, was to assume it was made from a metal so far out at the end of the table of elements that its nuclei, in any cosmos, were unstable. Fissionable. This object was not just a tank. It was a thermonuclear device several orders of magnitude larger than the largest ever made on Arb. The propellant tanks carried enough reaction mass to move it to an orbit antipodal to that of the mothership. If it were detonated, it would shine enough radiant energy onto Arb to set fire to whatever half of the planet could see it.
I don't think that the Veilers are really expecting to swarm over the world burner in spacesuits and subdue it with fisticuffs, I said. Actually, what impressed me most about them was their knowledge of military history and tactics.
Emmon held up his hands in surrender.
Don't get me wrong. I would like to have them on my side.
Again, I couldn't help see a hidden meaning. But then a bell rang. Like animals in a lab, we had learned to tell the bells apart, so we didn't have to look to know who it was for. Arcibald took a final gulp from his flagon and hustled out. Moira's voice was coming through on the speaker.
Uthentine and Erasmus were thousanders, so their treatise was not copied out into the Mathic world until the second millennial Convox.
She was speaking of the two Avowed who had developed the notion of complex protism.
Even then, it received scant notice until the 27th century when Fra Clathrond, a centenarian, later in his life a millenarian, at St. Edhar, casting an eye over these diagrams, remarked on the isomorphism between the causality arrows in these networks and the flow of time.
Isomorphism meaning? Asked Javarn.
Sameness of form. Time flows, or seems to flow, in one direction,
Paflagon said.
Events in the past can cause events in the present, but not vice versa, and time never loops round in a circle. Fra Clathrond pointed out something noteworthy, which is that information about the Canoans, the givens that flow along all of these arrows, behaves as if the Canoans were in the past.
Again, Emmon was staring off into space, drawing connections in his head.
Paflagon was also a hunterer from Edhar, right?
Yeah, I said. That's probably how he got interested in this topic. Probably found Clathrond's manuscripts lying around somewhere.
27th century, Emmon repeated.
So, Clathrond's works would have made it out to the Mathic world at large at the apertura of 2700? I nodded.
Just 8 decades before the rise of...
But he cut himself short and flicked his eyes nervously in my direction.
Before the third sack, I corrected him.